secularists tend to assume that religion was a primitive superstition outgrown by civilized, rational man. Some confidently predicted its imminent demise. At best, religion was a marginal and private activity which could no longer influence world events. Now, we realize that this was a false prophecy. In the Soviet Union, after decades of official atheism, men and women are demanding the right to practice their faith. In the West, people who have little interest in conventional doctrine and institutional churches have shown a new awareness of spirituality and the inner life. Most dramatically, perhaps, a radical religiosity, which we usually call fundamentalism, has erupted in most of the major religions. It is an intensely political form of belief, and some see it as a grave danger to world and civic peace. Governments ignore it at their peril. Yet again, as so often in the past, an age of skepticism has been followed by a period of intense religious fervor. Religion seems to be an important human need which cannot easily be disregarded or pushed to the sidelines, no matter how rational or sophisticated our society. Some will welcome this new age of faith, others will deplore it, but none of us can dismiss religion as irrelevant to the chief concerns of our century. The religious instinct is extremely powerful and can be used for good and ill. We must, therefore, understand it and examine its manifestations carefully, not only in our own society, but also in other cultures. Our dramatically shrunken world has revealed our inescapable connection with one another. We can no longer think of ourselves as separate from people in distant parts of the globe and leave them to their own fate. We have a responsibility to each other and face common dangers. It is also possible for us to acquire an appreciation of other civilizations that was unimaginable before our own day. For the first time, people all over the world are beginning to find inspiration in more than one religion, and many have adopted the faith of another culture. Thus, Buddhism is enjoying a great flowering in the West, where Christianity had once reigned supreme. But even when people have remained true to the faith of their fathers, they have sometimes been influenced by other traditions. Sir Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, the great Hindu philosopher and statesman, for example, was educated at the Christian College of Madras and strongly affected in the religious thought of people of both East and West. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who wrote his doctoral thesis in the two medieval Christian mystics, Nicholas of Cusa and Meister Eckhart, has been read enthusiastically by Christians and has had a profound influence on their ideas and spirituality. Jews tend to be less interested in Buber than are Christians, but they do read the Protestant theologian Paul Tillich and the modernist thinker Harvey Cox. The barriers of geographical distance, hostility and fear, which once kept the religions in separate, watertight compartments, are beginning to fall. Although much of the old prejudice remains, this is a hopeful development. It is particularly heartening, after centuries of virulent Christian antisemitism, to see Jewish and Christian scholars attempting to reach a new understanding. There is an incipient perception of the deep unity of mankind's religious experience and a realization that traditions, which we once despised, can speak to our own condition and revitalize our spirituality. The implication of this could be profound. We will never be able to see either our own or other people's religions and cultures in quite the same way again. The possible result of this has been compared to the revolution that science has effected in the outlook of man and women throughout the world. Many people will find this development extremely threatening, and they will erect new barricades against the other. But some are already beginning to glimpse broader horizons and find they are moved by religious ideals that their ancestors would have dismissed with contempt. But one major religion seems to be outside this circle of goodwill and, in the West at least, to have retained its negative image. People who are beginning to find inspiration in Zen or Taoism are usually not nearly so eager to look kindly upon Islam. Even though it is the third religion of Abraham and more in tune with our own Judeo-Christian tradition. In the West, we have a long history of hostility towards Islam that seems as entrenched as our anti-Semitism, which in recent years has seen a disturbing revival in Europe. At least, however, many people have developed a healthy fear of this ancient prejudice since the Nazi Holocaust. But the old hatred of Islam continues to flourish on both sides of the Atlantic, and people have few scruples about attacking this religion, even if they know little about it. The hostility is understandable, because until the rise of the Soviet Union in our own century, no polity or ideology posed such a continuous challenge to the West as Islam. When the Muslim Empire was established in the 7th century, Europe was a backward region. Islam had quickly overrun much of the Christian world of the Middle East, as well as the Great Church of North Africa, which had been of crucial importance to the Church of Rome. This brilliant success was threatening. Had God deserted the Christians and bestowed his favor on the infidel? Even when Europe recovered from the Dark Ages and established its own great civilization, the old fear of the ever-expanding Muslim Empire remained. Europe could make no impression on this powerful and dynamic culture. The crusading project of the 12th and 13th centuries eventually failed, and later the Ottoman Turks brought Islam to the very doorstep of Europe. This fear made it impossible for Western Christians to be rational or objective about the Muslim faith. At the same time as they were weaving fearful fantasies about Jews, they were also evolving a distorted image of Islam, which reflected their own buried anxieties. Western scholars denounced Islam as a blasphemous faith and its prophet Muhammad as the great pretender who had founded a violent religion of the sword in order to conquer the world. Mahomet became a bogey to the people of Europe, used by mothers to frighten disobedient children. In Mummer's play, he was presented as the enemy of Western civilization, who fought our own brave Saint George. This inaccurate image of Islam became one of the received ideas of Europe, and it continues to affect our perceptions of the Muslim world. The problem has been compounded by the fact that, for the first time in Islamic history, Muslims have begun to cultivate a passionate hatred for the West. In part, this is due to European and American behavior in the Islamic world. It is a mistake to imagine that Islam is an inherently violent or fanatical faith, as is sometimes suggested. Islam is a universal religion, and there is nothing aggressively oriental or anti-Western about it. Indeed, when Muslims first encountered the colonial West during the 18th century, many were impressed by its modern civilization and tried to emulate it. But in recent years, this initial enthusiasm has given way to bitter resentment. We should also remember that fundamentalism has surfaced in most religions as seems to be a worldwide response to the peculiar strain of late 20th century life. Radical Hindus have taken to the streets to defend the caste system and to oppose the Muslims of India. Jewish fundamentalists have made illegal settlements on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and have vowed to drive all Arabs from their holy land. Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority and the New Christian Right, which saw the Soviet Union as the evil empire, achieved astonishing power in the United States during the 1980s. It is wrong, therefore, to assume that Muslim extremists are typical of their faith. It would be just as mistaken to see the late Ayatollah Khomeini as the incarnation of Islam as to dismiss the rich and complex tradition of Judaism because of the immoral policies of the late Rabbi Meir Kahane. If fundamentalism seems particularly rife in the Muslim world, this is because of the population explosion. To give just one telling example, there were only 9 million Iranians before the Second World War. Today, there are 57 million, and their average age is 17. Radical Islam, with its extreme and black and white solutions, is a young person's faith. Most Westerners do not know enough about traditional Islam to assess this new strain and put it in a proper perspective. When Shiites in the Lebanon take hostages in the name of Islam, people in Europe and America naturally feel repelled by the religion itself, without realizing that this behavior contravenes important legislation in the Quran about the taking and treatment of captives. Regrettably, the media and the popular press do not always give us the help we need. Far more coverage, for example, was given to the Muslims who vociferously supported Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa against the British author Salman Rushdie than to the sheikhs of the prestigious Mosque of Al-Azhar in Cairo. Both condemned the fatwas as illegal and un-Islamic. The religious authorities of Saudi Arabia and the sheikhs of the prestigious Mosque of Al-Azhar in Cairo both condemned the fatwa as illegal and un-Islamic. Muslim law does not permit a man to be sentenced to death without trial and has no jurisdiction outside the Islamic world. At the Islamic Conference of March 1989, 44 out of 45 member states unanimously rejected the Ayatollah's ruling. But this received only cursory attention in the British press and left many people with the misleading impression that the entire Muslim world was clamoring for Rushdie's blood. Sometimes the media seems to stir up our traditional prejudices, as was particularly apparent during the OPEC oil crisis of 1973. The imagery used in cartoons, advertisements, and popular articles was rooted in old Western fears of a Muslim conspiracy to take over the world. Many people feel that Muslim society justifies our stereotypical view of it. Life seems cheap. Governments are sometimes corrupt or tyrannical. Women are oppressed. It is not uncommon for people to blame this state of affairs on Islam. But scholars warn us not to overemphasize the role of any religion on a given society. And Marshall G.S. Hodgson, the distinguished historian of Islam, points out that the aspects of the Muslim world condemned in the West are characteristic of most pre-modern societies. Life would not have been very different here 300 years ago. But sometimes there seems to be a definite desire to blame the faith itself for every disorder in the Muslim world. Thus, feminists frequently condemn Islam for the custom of female circumcision. This, despite the fact that it is really an African practice, is never mentioned in the Quran, is not prescribed by three of the four main schools of Islamic jurisprudence, and was absorbed into the fourth school in North Africa, where it was a fact of life. It is as impossible to generalize about Islam as about Christianity. There is a wide range of ideas and ideals in both. A clear example of stereotyping is the common assumption that the Islam practiced in Saudi Arabia is the most authentic form of faith. Seemingly more archaic, it is supposed to resemble that practiced by the first community of Muslims. Because the West has long considered the regime in Saudi Arabia obnoxious, it tends to write off Islam too. But Wahhabism is only an Islamic sect. It developed in the 18th century and was similar to the Christian Puritan sect that flourished during the 17th century in England, Netherlands, and Massachusetts. The Puritans and the Wahhabis both claimed to be returning to the response to the unique conditions of the time. Both Wahhabism and Puritanism exerted an important influence in the Muslim and Christian world respectively, but it is a mistake to view either sect as normative in their religion. Reform movements in any faith attempt to return to the original spirit of the founder, but it is never possible to reproduce former conditions entirely. I am not claiming that Islam is entirely faultless. All religions are human institutions and frequently make serious mistakes. All have sometimes expressed their faith in inadequate and even in abhorrent ways. But they have also been creative, enabling millions of men and women to find faith in the ultimate meaning and value of life, despite the suffering that flesh is heir to. To put Islam into an unholy category of its own, or to assume that its influence has been wholly or even predominantly negative, is both inaccurate and unjust. It is a betrayal of the tolerance and compassion that are supposed to characterize Western society. In fact, Islam shares many of the ideals and visions that have inspired both Judaism and Christianity. Consequently, it has helped people to cultivate values that it shares with our own culture. The Judeo-Christian tradition does not have a monopoly on either monotheism or concern for justice, decency, compassion, and respect for humanity. Indeed, the Muslim interpretation of the monotheistic faith has its own special genius and has important things to teach us. Ever since Islam came to my attention, I have been increasingly aware of this. Until a few years ago, I was almost entirely ignorant about the religion. The first inkling I had that it was a tradition that could speak to me came during a holiday in summer camp. There, I found the Islamic architecture to express a spirituality that resonated with my own Catholic past. In 1984, I had to make a television program about Sufism, the mysticism of Islam, and was particularly impressed by the Sufi appreciation of other religions, a quality that I had certainly not encountered in Christianity. This challenged everything that I had taken for granted about Islam, and I wanted to learn more. Finally, during a study of the Crusades and the current conflict in the Middle East, I was led to the life of Muhammad and to the Quran, the scripture that he brought to the Arabs. I am no longer a believing or practicing Christian, nor do I belong to any other official religion. But at the same time, as I have been devising my ideas about Islam, I have also been reconsidering the religious experience itself. In all the great religions, seers and prophets have conceived strikingly similar visions of a transcendent and ultimate reality, however we choose to interpret it. This human experience has been a fact. This human experience has been a fact of life. Indeed, Buddhists deny that there is anything supernatural about it. It is a state of mind that is natural to humanity. The monotheistic faiths, however, call this transcendence God. I believe that Muhammad had such an experience and made a distinctive and valuable contribution to the spiritual experience of humanity. If we are to do justice to our Muslim neighbors, we must appreciate this essential fact, and that is why I have written this book. There are surprisingly few accessible biographies of Muhammad for the general reader. I have been particularly indebted to the two volumes by Montgomery Watt, Muhammad at Mecca and Muhammad at Medina. But these are for students and presuppose a basic knowledge of Muhammad's life that not everybody has. Martin Link's Muhammad, his life and the earliest sources, gives a wealth of fascinating information from Muhammad's biographers of the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries. But Links is writing for the converted. An outsider will have many questions to ask of the basic, even of an argumentative nature, which Links does not address. Perhaps the most attractive of the biographies currently in print is Maxim Rodinson's Muhammad. Rodinson wears his considerable erudition lightly, and I have learned a great deal from this book. But he writes as a specific and a skeptic and a secularist. Concentrating as he does on the political and military aspects of the Prophet's life, he does not really help us to understand Muhammad's spiritual vision. My own approach has been rather different. We know more about Muhammad than about the founder of any other major faith, so that a study of his life can give us an important insight into the nature of the religious experience. All religions represent a dialogue between an absolute, ineffable reality and mundane events. In Muhammad's prophetic career, we can examine this process more closely than is usually possible. We shall see that Muhammad's spiritual experience bears an arresting similarity to that of the prophets of Israel, Saint Teresa of Avila and Dame Julian of Norwich. I have also used various incidents in the prophet to illustrate the particular emphases of the Muslim tradition. All major religions cover many of the same themes, but each has its own particular insight. Thus, we shall have to consider why Muslims regard politics as a religious duty. Muhammad achieved an extraordinary political success, and Christians tend to see such worldly triumphs as of questionable godliness. But is a Christ-like failure the only way to God? I also look at the Prophet from the point of view of a person with particular preconceptions about Islam. Thus, when we see Muhammad waging war against the city of Mecca, we shall have to ask whether he really did found a religion of the sword. How could a man of God be prepared to fight and kill? When we consider Muhammad's relationship with his wives and daughters, we must ask whether he really was a chauvinist or who founded a misogynistic religion. The Gulf War of 1991 showed that, whether we like it or not, we are deeply connected with the Muslim world. Despite temporary alliances, it is clear that the West has largely lost the confidence of people in the Islamic world. A breakdown in communications is never the fault of one party. And if the West is to regain the sympathy and respect that it once enjoyed in the Muslim world, it must examine its own role in the Middle East and consider its own difficulties vis-à-vis Islam. That is why the first chapter of this book traces the history of Western hatred for the Prophet of Islam. But the picture is not entirely black. From the earliest days, some Europeans were able to achieve a more balanced view. They were always in a minority, and they had their failings, but this handful of people tried to correct the errors of their contemporaries and rise above received opinion. It is surely this more tolerant, compassionate, and courageous tradition that we should seek to encourage now.
You're listening to WRPI Troy. We will be back in a moment.
It was particularly disturbing for people in Britain to learn that the Muslim communities in their own cities lived according to different, apparently alien values, and were ready to defend them to the death. But there were also uncomfortable reminders of the Western past in this tragic affair. When British people watched the Muslims of Bradford burning the novel, did they relate this to the bonfires of books that had blazed in Christian Europe over the centuries? In 1242, for example, King Louis IX of France, a canonized saint of the Roman Catholic Church, condemned the Jewish Talmud as a vicious attack on the person of Christ. The book was banned and copies were publicly burned in the presence of the king. Louis had no interests in discussing his differences with the Jewish communities of France in a peaceful, rational way. He once claimed that the only way to debate with a Jew was to kill him with a good thrust in the belly as far as the sword will go. It was Louis who called the first Inquisition to bring Christian heretics to justice and burned not merely their books, but hundreds of men and women. He was also a Muslim hater and led two crusades against the Islamic world. In Louis's day, it was not Islam, but the Christian West, which found it impossible to coexist with others. Indeed, the bitter history of Muslim-Western relations can be said to have begun with an attack on Muhammad in Muslim Spain. In 850, a monk called Perfectus went shopping in the souk of Cordova, capital of the Muslim state of Al-Andalus. Here, he was accosted by a group of Arabs who asked him whether Jesus or Muhammad was the greater prophet. Perfectus understood at once that it was a trick question, because it was a capital offense in the Islamic Empire to insult Muhammad. And at first he responded cautiously, but suddenly he snapped and burst into a passionate stream of abuse, calling the Prophet of Islam a charlatan, sexual pervert, and Antichrist himself. He was immediately swept off to Gaul. This incident was unusual for Cordova, where Christian-Muslim relations were normally good. Like the Jews, Christians were allowed full religious liberty within the Islamic Empire, and most Spaniards were proud to belong to such an advanced culture, light years ahead on the rest of Europe. They were often called Mozarabs or Arabizans. Christians loved to read the poems and romance of the Arabs. They studied the Arab theologians and philosophers, not to refute them, but to form a correct and elegant Arabic. Where is the layman who now reads the Latin commentaries on the Holy Scriptures, or who studies the Gospels, prophets or apostles? Alas, all talented young Christians read and study with enthusiasm the Arab books. Paul Alvaro, the Spanish layman who wrote this attack on the Mozarabs at about this time, saw the monk Perfectus as a cultural and religious hero. His denunciation of Muhammad had inspired a strange minority movement in Cordoba, whereby men and women presented themselves before the Qadi, the Islamic judge, and proved their Christian loyalty by a vitriolic and suicidal attack on the Prophet. When Perfectus had arrived in Gaol, he had been extremely frightened, and the Qadi, the judge, decided not to pass the death sentence because he judged that Perfectus had been unfairly provoked by the Muslims. But after a few days, Perfectus cracked a second time and insulted Muhammad in such crude terms that the Qadi had no option but to apply the full rigor of the law. The monk was executed, and at once a group of Christians who seemed to have lived on the fringes of society dismembered his body and began to revere relics of their martyr. A few days later, another monk called Isaac appeared before the judge and attacked Muhammad and his religion with such passion that the Qadi, the judge, thinking him either drunk or deranged, slapped him to bring him to his senses. But Isaac persisted in his abuse, and the Qadi could not continue to permit this flagrant violation of the law. 9th century Cordoba was not like Bradford in 1988. The Muslims were powerful and confident. They seemed extremely reluctant to put these Christian fanatics to death, partly because they did not seem in control of their faculties, but also because they realized that the last thing they needed was a martyr cult. Muslims were not averse to hearing about other religions. Islam had been born in the religious pluralism of the Middle East, where the various faiths had coexisted for centuries. The Eastern Christian Empire of Byzantium, likewise, permitted minority religious groups liberty to practice their faith and to manage their own religious affairs. There was no law against propaganda efforts by Christians in the Islamic Empire, provided that they did not attack the beloved figure of the Prophet Muhammad. In some parts of the empire, there was even an established tradition of skepticism and free thinking, which was tolerated as long as it is kept within the bounds of decency and was not too disrespectful. In Cordoba, the Qadi, the judge, and the emir, the prince, were both loath to put Perfectus and Ishaq to death, but they could not allow this breach of the law. But a few days after Ishaq's execution, 6 other monks from his monastery arrived and delivered yet another venomous attack on Muhammad. That summer, about 50 martyrs died in this way. They were denounced by the Bishop of Cordoba and by the Mozarabs, who were all extremely alarmed by this aggressive cult of martyrdom. But the martyrs found 2 champions, a priest called Eulogio and Paul Alvaro. Both argued that the martyrs were soldiers of God, who were fighting bravely for their faith. They had mounted a complex moral assault against Islam, which was difficult for the Muslim authorities to deal with because it seemed to put them in the wrong. The martyrs came from all levels of society. They were men and women, monks, priests, laymen, simple folk, and sophisticated scholars. But many seem to have been searching for a clear, distinct Western identity. Some appear to have come from mixed homes with a Muslim and a Christian parent. Others had been urged to assimilate too closely with Muslim culture. They had been given Arab names or had been pushed into a career in the civil service and felt disoriented and confused. The loss of cultural roots can be a profoundly disturbing experience, and even in our own day, it can produce an aggressive, defiant religiosity as a means of asserting the beleaguered sense. Perhaps we should remember the martyrs of Cordova when we feel bewildered by the hostility and rage in some of the Muslim communities in the West and in other parts of the world where Western culture threatens traditional values. The martyr movement led by Alvaro and Eulogio was as bitterly opposed to the Christian Mozarabs as to the Muslims, and accused them of being cultural defectors. Eulogio made a visit to Pamplona in neighboring Christendom and came back with Western books, texts of the Latin fathers of the Church and Roman classical works by Virgil and Juvenal. He wanted to resist the Arabization of his fellow Spaniards and create a Latin Renaissance which looked back with nostalgia to the Roman past of his country and as a way of neutralizing the influence of the dominant Muslim culture. The movement fizzled out when Eulogio himself was put to death by the Qadi, who begged him to save his life by making a token submission to Islam. Nobody would check his subsequent religious behavior and not give in to this deplorable and fatal self-destruction like the other fools and idiots. But Eulogio merely told him to sharpen his sword. This curious incident was uncharacteristic of life in Muslim Spain. For the next 600 years, members of the three religions of historical monotheism were able to live together in relative peace and harmony. The Jews, who were being hounded to death in the rest of Europe, were able to enjoy a rich cultural renaissance of their own. But the story of the martyrs of Cordova reveals an attitude that would become common in the West. At that time, Islam was a great world power, while Europe, overrun by barbarian tribes, had become a cultural backwater. Later, the whole world would seem to be Islamic, rather, as it seems, Western today. And Islam was a continuous challenge to the West until the 18th century. Now it seems that the Cold War against the Soviet Union is about to be replaced by a Cold War against Islam. I shall continue to read from the works of Karen Armstrong. The excerpts I shared with you were from her work, A Biography of the Prophet, by HarperCollins. Now, in the almost 15 minutes that we have left, I'm going to move to another article of hers entitled Ghosts of Our Past. To win the war on terrorism, you first need to understand its roots, by Karen Armstrong. About 100 years ago, almost every leading Muslim intellectual was in love with the West, which at that time meant Europe. America was still an unknown quantity. Politicians and journalists in India, Egypt, and Iran wanted their countries to be just like Britain or France. Philosophers, poets, and even some of the religious scholars tried to find ways of reforming Islam according to the democratic model of the West. They called for a nation state for representational government, for the disestablishment of religion, and for constitutional rights. Some even claimed that the Europeans were better Muslims than their own fellow countrymen, since the Quran teaches that the resources of the society must be shared as fairly as possible, and in the European nations there was beginning to be a more equitable sharing of wealth. So what happened in the intervening years to transform all of that admiration and respect into the hatred that incited the acts of terror that we witnessed on September 11th? It is not only terrorists who feel this anger and resentment, although they do so to an extreme degree. Throughout the Muslim world, there is widespread bitterness against America, even among pragmatic and well-educated businessmen and professionals, who may sincerely deplore the recent atrocities, condemn them as evil, and feel sympathy with the victims, but who still resent the way Western powers have behaved in their countries. This atmosphere is highly conducive to extremism, especially now that potential terrorists have seen the catastrophe that it is possible to inflict using only the simplest of weapons. Even if President Bush and our allies succeed in eliminating the threat posed by bin Laden and his network, hundreds more terrorists will rise up to their place unless we in the West address the root cause of this hatred. This task must be an essential part of the war against terrorism. We cannot understand the present crisis without taking into account the painful process of modernization. In the 16th century, the countries of Western Europe and later the American colonies embarked on what historians have called the Great Western Transformation. Until then, all the great societies were based upon a surplus of agriculture and so were economically vulnerable. They soon found that they had grown beyond their limited resources. The new Western societies, though, were based upon technology and the constant reinvestment of capital. They found that they could reproduce the resources indefinitely, and so could afford to experiment with new ideas and products. In Western cultures today, when a new kind of computer is invented, all the old office equipment is thrown out. In the old agrarian societies, any project that required such frequent change of the basic infrastructure was likely to be shelved. Originality was not encouraged. Instead, people had to concentrate on preserving what had been achieved. So while the Great Western Transformation was exciting and gave the people of the West more freedom, it demanded fundamental change at every level: social, political, intellectual, and religious. Not surprisingly, the period of transition was traumatic and violent, as the early modern states became more centralized and efficient. Draconian measures were often required to weld hitherto disparate kingdoms together. Some minority groups, such as the Catholics in England and the Jews in Spain, were persecuted or deported. There were acts of genocide, terrible wars of religion, the exploitation of workers in factories, the despoliation of the countryside, and anomy and spiritual malaise in the newly industrialized megacities. Successful modern societies found, by trial and error, that they had to be democratic. The reasons were many. In order to preserve the momentum of the continually expanding economy, more people had to be involved, even in a humble capacity as printers, clerks, or factory workers. To do these jobs, they needed to be educated, and once they became educated, they began to demand political rights. In order to draw upon all of society's resources, modern countries also found they had to bring out groups. They had to bring out groups, such as the Jews and women into the mainstream. Countries like those in Eastern Europe that did not become secular, tolerant, and democratic fell behind. But those that did fulfill these norms, including Britain and France, became so powerful that no agrarian traditional society, such as those of the Islamic countries, could stand against them. Today, we are witnessing similar upheaval in developing countries, including those in the Islamic world, that are making their own painful journey to modernity. In the Middle East, we see constant political turmoil that have been revolutions, such as the 1952 coup of the free officers in Egypt, and the Islamic revolution in Iran in 1979. Autocratic rulers predominate in this region because the modernizing process is not yet sufficiently advanced to provide the conditions for a fully developed democracy. In the West, we have completed the modernizing process and have forgotten what we had to go through. So we do not always understand the difficulty of this transition. We tend to imagine that we have always been in the van of progress, and we see the Islamic countries as inherently backward. We have imagined that they are held back by their religion and do not realize that what we are actually seeing is an imperfectly modernized society. The Muslim world has had an especially problematic experience with modernity because its people have had to modernize so rapidly in 50 years instead of 300 years that it took the Western world. Nevertheless, this in itself would not have been an insuperable obstacle. Japan, for example, has created its own highly successful version of modernity. But Japan had one huge advantage over most of the Islamic countries. It had never been colonized. In the Muslim world, modernity did not bring freedom and independence. It came in a context of political subjection. Modern society is of its very nature progressive, and by the 19th century, the new economies of Western Europe needed a constantly expanding market for the goods that funded their controlled enterprises. Once the home countries were saturated, new markets were sought abroad. In 1798, Napoleon defeated the Mamluks, Egypt's military rulers, in the Battle of the Pyramids near Cairo. Between 1830 and 1915, the European powers occupied Algeria, Aden, Tunisia, Sudan, Libya, and Morocco, all Muslim countries. These new colonies provided raw materials for export, which were fed into European industry. In return, they received cheap manufactured goods, which naturally destroyed local industry. This new impotence was extremely disturbing for the Muslim countries. Until this point, Islam had been a religion of success. Within 100 years of the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632, the Muslims ruled an empire that stretched from the Himalayas to the Pyrenees. By the 15th century, Islam was the greatest world power, not dissimilar to the United States today. When Europeans began to explore the rest of the globe at the beginning of the Great Western Transformation, they found Islamic presence almost everywhere they went. In the Middle East, India, Persia, Southeast Asia, China, and Japan. In the 16th century, when Europe was in the early stages of its rise to power, the Ottoman Empire, which ruled Turkey, the Middle East, and North Africa, was probably the most powerful state in the world. But once the great powers of Europe had reformed their military, economic, and political structures according to the modern norm, the Islamic countries could put up no effective resistance. Muslims would not be human if they did not resent being subjugated this way. The colonial powers treated the natives with contempt. And it was not long before Muslims discovered that their new rulers despised their religious traditions. Sure, Europeans brought many improvements to their colonies, such as modern medicine, education, and technology. But these were sometimes a mixed blessing. Thus, the Suez Canal, initiated by the French consul Ferdinand de Lesseps, was a disaster for Egypt, which in the end had to provide all the money, labor, and materials, as well as donate 200 square miles of Egyptian territory gratis. And yet, the sharing of the canal company were all held by Europeans. The immense outlay helped to bankrupt Egypt, and this gave Britain a pretext to set up a military occupation there in 1882 in order to protect the interests of the shareholders. Railways were installed in the colonies, but they rarely benefited the local people. Instead, they were designed to further the colonialists' own projects, and the missionary schools often taught the children to despise their own culture, which, with the result that many felt they belonged neither to the West nor to the Islamic world. One of the most scaring effects of colonialism is the rift that still exists between those who have had a Western education and those who have not, and remain perforce stuck in the pre-modern ethos. To this day, the westernized elites of these countries and the more traditional classes simply cannot understand one another. After World War II, Britain and France became secondary powers, and the United States became the leader of the Western world. Even though the Islamic countries were no longer colonies, but were nominally independent, America still controlled their destinies. During the Cold War, the United States sought allies in the region by supporting unsavory governments and unpopular leaders, largely to protect its oil interests. One example of this occurred in 1953, after Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi had been deposed and forced to leave Iran. He was put back on the throne in a coup engineered by British intelligence and the CIA. The United States continued to support the Shah, even though he denied Iranian human rights that most Americans take for granted. Saddam Hussein, who became the president of Iraq in 1979, was also a protege of the United States, which literally allowed him to get away with murder, most notably the chemical attack against the Kurdish population. It was only after the invasion of 1990 of Kuwait, a critical oil-producing state, that Hussein incurred the enmity of America and its allies. Many Muslims resent the way America has continued to support unpopular rulers. Indeed, bin Laden was himself a protege of the West, which was happy to support and fund his fighters in the struggle for Afghanistan against Soviet Russia. Too often, the Western powers have taken a crudely short-term view and have not considered the long-term consequences of their actions. After the Soviets had pulled out of Afghanistan, for example, no help was forthcoming from the devastated country, whose ensuing chaos made it possible for the Taliban to come to power. In conclusion of this, our article finishes by saying the following. The Quran insists that the only just war is one of self-defense, but the terrorists would claim that it is America which is the aggressor. They would point out that during the past year, hundreds of Palestinians have died in the conflict with Israel, America's ally. The homes of Palestinian Muslims have been bombarded with American shells, that Britain and America are still bombing Iraq, and that thousands of Iraqi civilians, many of them children, have died as a result of the American-led sanctions. None of this, of course, excuses the September atrocities. These were evil actions, and it is essential that all those implicated in any way be brought to justice. But what can we do to prevent repetition of this tragedy? So we in the first world must develop a one-world mentality in the coming years. Americans have often assumed that they were protected by the great ocean surrounding the United States. As a result, they have not always been very well informed about other parts of the globe. But the September apocalypse and the events that followed have shown that this isolation has come to an end and revealed America's terrifying vulnerability. This is deeply frightening, and it will have a profound effect upon the American psyche. But this tragedy could be turned to good if we in the first world cultivate a new sympathy with other peoples who have suffered mass slaughter and experienced a similar helplessness. Rwanda, Lebanon, or Srebrenica.
Thank you for joining us for Window on a Spine at our new time from 4:30 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. on Fridays. We'll be back next week for a new edition. Thank you and have a good evening.
He's lazy. She's stupid. He's a racist. That one's greedy. And there's a terrorist.
If you look at people and all you see are labels, everyone loses.
Labels hurt all of us, and they're wrong.
Every one of us is unique, a one-of-a-kind original.
Every one of us is a one-of-a-kind original.
Every one of us is a one-of-a-kind original. Our diversity is our strength. Instead of stereotyping, we can all learn from each other.
Don't let prejudice shape your view. Take the time to get to know people and see for yourself who they really are.
We are all one, one of a kind.
Stereotyping is wrong, and it hurts all of us. Stop stereotyping.
A message from your American Muslim neighbors and the Islamic Media Foundation.
This is WRPI Troy.
Voices, 91.5 FM.